a finicky smile on the policeman's face as he swung, his free hand grasping his opposite lapel in some feminine way, the leather glove of the hand with the truncheon unbuttoned at the wrist, and his eyes flinching at the last possible moment as if the truncheon shared his nerves and might get hurt against the old man's skull. Pöckler made it to a doorway, sick with fear. Other police came running as some dancers run, elbows close to sides, forearms thrusting out at an angle. They used fire hoses to break up the crowd, finally. Women slid like dolls along the slick cobbles and on tram rails, the thick gush catching them by belly and head, its brute white vector dominating them. Any of them might have been Lainey. Pöckler shivered in his doorway and watched it. He couldn't go out in the street. Later he thought about its texture, the network of grooves between the paving stones. The only safety there was ant-scaled. Down and running the streets of Ant City, boot-soling overhead like black thunder, you and your crawling neighbors in traffic all silent, jostling, heading down the gray darkening streets. Pöckler knew how to find safety among the indoor abscissas and ordinates of graphs. Finding the points he needed not by running the curve itself, not up on high stone and vulnerability, but instead tracing patiently the X's and Y's, P, at you in parentheses, W, meters per second in parentheses, T sub 1, degrees Kelvin in parentheses, moving always by safe right angles along the faint lines. When he began to dream about the rocket with some frequency, it would sometimes not be a literal rocket at all, but a street he knew was in a certain district of the city, a street on a certain small area of the grid that held something he thought he needed. The coordinates were clear in his mind, but the street eluded him. Over the years, as the rocket neared its fullness, about to go operational, the coordinates switched from the Cartesian X and Y of the laboratory to the polar azimuth and range of the weapon as deployed. Once he knelt on the laboratory floor of his old rooming house in Munich, understanding that if he faced exactly along a certain compass bearing, his prayer would be heard. He'd be safe. He wore a robe of gold and orange brocade. It was the only light in the room. Afterward, he ventured out into the house, knowing people slept in all the rooms, but feeling a sense of desertion. He went to switch on a light, but in the act of throwing the switch, he knew the room had really been lit to begin with, and he had just turned everything out. Everything. The A4 operational at last hadn't crept up on him. Its coming true was no climax. That hadn't ever been the point. "They're using you to kill people," Lainey told him as clearly as she could. "That's their only job, and you're helping them." "We'll all use it someday to leave the earth to transcend," she laughed. "Transcend? From Pöckler?" "Someday," honestly trying. "They won't have to kill. Borders won't mean anything. We'll have all outer space."
"Oh, you're blind."
Spitting it, as she spat his blindness at him every day. That and Kadavergehorsamkeit. A beautiful word he can no longer imagine in any voice but hers. But really, he did not obey like a corpse. He was political, up to a point. There was politics enough out at the rocket field. The Army Weapons Department was showing an ever-quickening interest in the amateur rocketeers of the Verein für Raumschifffahrt. And the VFR had recently begun making available to the Army records of their experiments. The corporations and the universities, the Army said, didn't want to risk capital or manpower on developing anything as fantastic as a rocket. The Army had nowhere to turn but to private inventors and clubs like the VFR.
"Shit," said Lainey. "They're all in on it together. You really can't see that, can you?"
Within the society, the lines were drawn clear enough. Without money, the VFR was suffocating. The Army had the money and was already financing them in roundabout ways. The choice was between building what the Army wanted, practical hardware, or pushing on in chronic poverty, dreaming of expeditions to Venus.
"Where do you think the Army's getting the money?" Lainey asked.
"What does it matter? Money is money."
"No."
Major Weissmann was one of several gray eminences around the rocket field, able to talk with every appearance of sympathy and reason to organized thinker and maniac idealist alike. All things to all men, a brand new military type, part salesman, part scientist. Pöckler, the all-seeing, the unmoving, must have known that what went on in the VFR committee meetings was the same game being played in Lainey's violent and shelterless street. All his training had encouraged an eye for analogies, in equations, in theoretical models, yet he persisted in thinking the VFR was special, preserved against the time. And he also knew at first hand what happens to dreams with no money to support them. So, presently, Ferkler found that by refusing to take sides, he'd become Weissmann's best ally. The major's eyes always changed when he looked at Ferkler, his slightly prissy face to relax into what Ferkler had noticed in random mirrors and display windows on his own face when he was with Laney. The blank look of one who is taking another for granted. Weissmann was as sure of Ferkler's role as Ferkler was of Laney's, but Laney left at last. Ferkler might not have had the will. He thought of himself as a practical man. At the rocket field, they talked continents, encirclements, seeing years before the general staff the need for a weapon to break ententes, to leap like a chess knight over panzers, infantry, even the Luftwaffe. Plutocratic nations to the west, communists to the east, spaces, models, game strategies, not much passion or ideology, practical men. While the military wallowed in victories not yet won, the rocket engineers had to think non-fanatically about German reverses, German defeat, the attrition of the Luftwaffe and its decline in power, the withdrawals of fronts, the need for weapons with longer ranges. But others had the money, others gave the orders, trying to superimpose their lusts on something that had its own vitality, on a technologique they'd never begin to understand. As long as the rocket was in research and development, there was no need for them to believe in it. Later, as the A4 was going operational, as they found themselves with a real rocket in being, the struggles for power would begin in earnest. Ferkler could see that. They were athletic, brainless men without vision, without imagination, but they had power, and it was hard for him not to think of them as superior, even while holding them in a certain contempt. But Laney was wrong. No one was using him. Ferkler was an extension of the rocket long before it was ever built. She'd seen to that. When she left him, he fell apart. Pieces spilled into the Hinterhof, down the drains, away in the wind. He couldn't even go to the movies. Only rarely did he go out after work and try to fish lumps of coal from the Spree. He drank beer and sat in the cold room, autumn light reaching him after impoverishments and fadings from gray clouds off courtyard walls and drain pipes, through grease-darkened curtains, bled of all hope by the time it reached where he sat shivering and crying. He cried every day, some hour of the day, for a month, till a sinus got infected. He went to bed and sweated the fever out. Then he moved to Kummersdorf, outside Berlin, to help his friend Mondaugen at the rocket field. Temperatures, velocities, pressures, fin and body configurations, stabilities and turbulences began to slip in to replace what Laney had run away from. There were pine and fir forests out the windows in the morning instead of a sorrowful city courtyard. Was he giving up the world, entering a monastic order? One night he set fire to 20 pages of calculations. Integral signs weaved like charmed cobras. Comical curly D's marched along like hunchbacks through the fire edge into billows of lace ash. But that was his only relapse. At first he helped out in the propulsion group. No one was specializing yet. That came later when the bureaus and paranoia and the organization charts became plan views of prison cells. Kurt Mondaugen, whose field was radioelectronics, could come up with solutions to cooling problems. Ferkler found himself redesigning instrumentation for measuring local pressures. That came in handy later at Peenemünde, when they often had to lead over 100 measuring tubes from a model no more than 4 or 5 centimeters diameter. Ferkler helped in working out the Hauptmodell solution, bisecting the model lengthwise and mounting it flat side to the wall of the test chamber, bringing the tubes through that way to all the manometers outside. A Berlin slum dweller, he thought, knew how to think in half rations, but it was a rare moment of pride. No one could really claim credit 100% for any idea. It was a corporate intelligence at work. Specialization hardly mattered, class lines even less. The social spectrum ran from von Braun, the Prussian aristocrat, down to the likes of Ferkler, who would eat an apple in the street. Yet they were all equally at the rocket's mercy. Not only danger from explosions or falling hardware, but also its dumbness, its dead weight, its obstinate and palpable mystery. In those days, most of the funding and attention went to the propulsion group. Problem was just to get something off the ground without having it blow up. There were minor disasters. Aluminum motor casings would burn through. Some injector designs would set up resonant combustion in which the burning motor would try to shriek itself to pieces. And then in 34, a major one. Dr. Vamke decided to mix peroxide and alcohol together before injection into the thrust chamber to see what would happen. The ignition flame backed up through the conduit into the tank. The blast demolished the test stand, killing Dr. Vamke and two others. First blood. First sacrifice. Kurt Montaugen took it as a sign. German mystics who grew up reading Hesse, Stefan George, and Richard Wilhelm, ready to accept Hitler on the basis of Damian metaphysics, he seemed to look at fuel and oxidizer as paired opposites, male and female principles uniting in the mystical egg of the combustion chamber, creation and destruction, fire and water, chemical plus and chemical minus. Valency, Perkler protested, a condition of the outer shells, that's all. Think about it, said Montaugen. Faringer, an aerodynamics man, who went out in the pine woods at Peenemünde with his Zen bow and roll of pressed straw to practice breathing, draw and loosing over and over. It seemed rather rude at a time when his colleagues were being driven insane by what they called Folksamkeitfaktor, a problem with getting the rocket's long axis to follow the tangent at all points to its trajectory. The rocket for this Faringer was a fat Japanese arrow. It was necessary in some way to become one with rocket, trajectory, and target. Not to will it, but to surrender out of the role of firer. The act is undivided. You are both aggressor and victim. Rocket and parabolic path, and... Peckler never knew what the man was talking about. But Montaugen understood. Montaugen was the bodhisattva here, returned from exile in the Kalahari and whatever light had found him there, returned to the world of men and nations to carry on in a role he'd chosen deliberately, but without ever explaining why. In Südwest he had kept no journals, written no letters home. There had been an uprising by the Bundo Schwarz in 1922, and general turmoil in the country. His radio experiments interrupted, he sought refuge, along with a few score other whites, in the villa of a local landowner. The place was old, cut off on all sides by deep ravines. After a few months of siege and debauchery, haunted by a profound disgust for everything European, Montaugen went out alone into the bush, ended up living with the Ovadjimba, the aardvark people who are the poorest of the Hereros. They accepted him with no questions. He thought of himself, there and here, as a radio transmitter of some kind, and believed that whatever he was broadcasting at the time was a... In his electro-mysticism, Schriode was as basic as the cross in Christianity. Think of the ego, the self that suffers a personal history bound to him as the grid. The deeper and true self is the flow between cathode and plate, the constant, pure flow. Signals, sense data, feelings, memories creating are put onto the grid and modulate the flow. We live lives that are waveforms, constantly changing with time, now positive, now negative. Only at moments of great serenity is it possible to find the pure, the informationless state of signal zero.
In the name of the cathode, the anode, and the holy grid? Said Puckler.
Yes, that's good, Montaugen smiled. Closest to the zero among them all, perhaps, was the African Ensign, the protege of Major Weissmann. At the Versuchsanstalt, behind his back, he was known as Weissmann's monster, probably less out of racism than at the picture the two of them made, Ensign towering a foot over Weissmann, who was balding, scholarly, peering up at the African through eyeglass lenses thick as bottles, skipping now and then to keep up as they stalked over the asphalt and through the labs and offices, Ensign dominating every room and landscape of those early rocket days. Perkler's dearest memory of him is his first, in the testing room at Kummersdorf, surrounded by electric colors, green nitrogen bottles, a thick tangle of red, yellow, and blue plumbing, Ensign's own copper face with the same kind of serenity that now and then drifted into Montaugen's. Watching in one of the mirrors the image of a rocket engine beyond the safety partition, in the stale air of that room snapping with last-minute anxieties, nicotine craving, unreasonable prayer, Ensign was at peace. Perkler moved to Peenemünde in 1937, along with some 90 others. They were invading gravity itself, and a beachhead had to be laid down. Never in his life, not even as a laborer in Berlin, did Perkler work so hard. The vanguard spent the spring and summer converting a little island, the Greifswalder Oie, into a testing station. Resurfacing road, stringing cable and telephone line, putting up living quarters, latrines, and storage sheds, excavating bunkers, mixing concrete, endlessly stevedoring in crates of tools, bags of cement, drums of fuel. They used an ancient ferry boat for cargo runs between the mainland and the Oie. Fickler remembers the worn red plush and scratched lacquer inside the dim cabins, the neglected brightwork, the asthmatic cry of her steam whistle, odors of sweat, cigarette smoke, and diesel fuel, the trembling of arm and leg muscles, the tired joking, the exhaustion toward the end of each day, his own new calluses struck to gold by the late sun. The sea was mostly calm and blue that summer, but in the autumn the weather turned. Rain swept in from the north, the temperature plunged, wind tore into storage tents, giant waves boomed all night long. The water was white for 50 meters out from shore. Spray feathered landward all the big breakers. Perkler, billeted at a fisherman's cottage, came in from his evening walks behind a fine mask of salt. Lot's wife. What disaster had he dared to look back on? He knew. He reverted that season to childhood, to the wounded dog. During those wet and solitary walks, he brooded about Lainey. He concocted scenarios in which they would meet again in some elegant or dramatic setting, ministry, theater lobby. Two or three jeweled and beautiful women hanging to him, generals and industrialists springing to light his American cigarettes and listening to his offhand solutions to problems Lainey would only vaguely understand. The most satisfying of these fantasies would come while Perkler was on the toilet. He'd tap his feet. Fanfares would whisper through his lips as he felt that pleasant anticipation. But the burden of his poor Berlin self lingered. He had spoken of it, listened, probed, and yet it would not dissolve or flee. It persisted, begging all the doorways of his life, beseeching silently with eyes, with hands quite sure of their guilt-making craft. Busy work at Peenemünde and good company at Herr Halliger's inn on the Oie. All marking time till good firing weather, and Perkler more vulnerable than he'd ever been. His cold and womanless nights, the card and chess games, the all-male beer-drinking sessions, the nightmares he had to find his own way up out of because there was no other hand now to shake him awake, nobody to hold him when the shadows came on the window shade, all caught up with him that November, and maybe he allowed a protective reflex because something scary was happening. Because once or twice, deep in the ephedrine pre-dawns, nodding, ya, ya, stimmt, ya, for some design you were carrying, not in but on your bobbing, out past your side vision, bobbing and balanced almost, he would become aware of a drifting away. Some assumption of Perkler into the calculations, drawings, graphs, and even what raw hardware there was, each time, soon as it happened, he would panic and draw back into the redoubt of waking Perkler, heart pounding, hands and feet aching, his breath catching in a small-voiced, Something was out to get him. Something here among the paper. The fear of extinction named Perkler knew it was the rocket beckoning him in. If he also knew that in something like this extinction he could be free of his loneliness and his failure, still he wasn't quite convinced. So he hunted as a servo valve with a noisy input will across the zero between the two desires, personal identity and impersonal salvation. Mondhagen saw it all. He could see into Perkler's heart. In his compassion, not surprisingly, he had no free advice for his friend. Perkler would have to find his own way to his zero signal, his true course. By 38, the Peenemünde facility was taking shape, and Perkler moved over to the mainland. With hardly more to go on than Stodda's treatise on steam turbines and helpful data now and then from universities at Hanover, Darmstadt, Leipzig, and Dresden, the propulsion group were testing a rocket engine of 1.5 tons thrust, 10 atmospheres combustion pressure, and 60 seconds duration. They were getting exhaust velocities of 1,800 meters per second, but the value they were aiming for was 2,000. They called it the magic number, and they meant it literally. as some gamblers on the stock market know when to place stop orders, feeling by instinct not the printed numbers but the rates of change, knowing from first and second derivatives in their skin when to come in, stay, or go, so there are engineering reflexes tuned always to know, at any moment, what, given the resources, can be embodied in working hardware. What is feasible? On the day that a 2,000 meter per second exhaust became feasible, the A4 itself suddenly came in reach. The danger then lay in being seduced by approaches that were too sophisticated. No one was immune. Hardly a designer there, including Pöckler, didn't come up with at least one monster rig, some gorgon's head, writhing with pipes, tubes, complicated falderol for controlling pressures, solenoids on top of pilot valves, on auxiliary valves, on backup valves. Hundreds of pages on valve nomenclature were printed as appendices to these weird proposals, all promising huge pressure differences between the inside of the chamber and the nozzle exit. Beautiful, as long as you didn't care much about those millions of moving parts behaving together too reliably. But to get a dependable working motor, one the military could use in the field to kill people, the real engineering problem now was to keep things as simple as possible. The model currently being fired was the A3, christened not with champagne, but with flasks of liquid oxygen by the playful technicians. Emphasis had begun to shift from propulsion to guidance. Telemetry on the flight tests was still primitive. Thermometers and barometers were sealed in a watertight compartment with a movie camera. During flights, the camera photographed the needles swinging on the gauges. After the flight, the film was recovered and the data played back. Engineers sat around looking at movies of dials. Meantime, Heinkels were also dropping iron models of the rocket from 20,000 feet. The fall was photographed by Ascanius and a theodolite rigs on the ground. In the daily rushes, you would watch the frames at around 3,000 feet where the model broke through the speed of sound. There has been this strange connection between the German mind and the rapid flashing of successive stills to counterfeit movement for at least two centuries. Since Leibniz, in the process of inventing calculus, used the same approach to break up the trajectories of cannonballs through the air. And now Pöckler was about to be given proof that these techniques had been extended past images on film to human lives. He had returned to his quarters about sundown, too tired or preoccupied to be much affected by the furnace of colors in the flower gardens, the daily changes to the skyline of the station, even the absence of noise today from the testing stands. He smelled the ocean and could almost imagine himself as someone who lives year-round at a seaside resort but seldom gets to the beach. Now and then, over in Peenemünde West, a fighter plane took off or landed, the motors softened by distance to tranquil purring. A late sea breeze flickered. He had no warning other than a smile from a colleague who lived a few cubicles away and was coming down the barrack stairs as Pöckler was going up. He entered his own cubicle and saw her sitting on the bed, her toes pointed in next to a flowered carpet bag, skirt pulled over her knees, and eyes anxiously, fatally, looking into his. Herr Pöckler, I am your Ilse. Ilse. He must have picked her up, kissed her, drawn the curtain. Some reflex. She was wearing in her hair a ribbon of brown velvet. He remembered her hair as lighter, shorter, but then it does grow and darken. He looked slantwise into her face, all his emptiness echoing. The vacuum of his life threatened to be broken in one strong inrush of love. He tried to maintain it with seals of suspicion, looking for resemblances to the face he'd last seen years ago over her mother's shoulder, eyes still puffy from sleep angled down across Lainey's rain-coated back. Going out a door he thought closed for good, pretending not to find resemblances. Perhaps pretending. Was it really the same face? He'd lost so much of it over the years, that fat, featureless child's face. He was afraid now even to hold her, afraid his heart would burst. He said, "How long have you been waiting?" "Since lunchtime?" She'd eaten in the canteen. Major Weissmann had brought her up on the train from Stettin, and they had played chess. Major Weissmann was a slow player, and they hadn't finished the game. Major Weissmann had bought her sweets, and had asked her to say hello, and sorry he couldn't stay long enough to see Pöckler. Weissmann, what was this? A blinking, tentative fury grew in Pöckler. They must have known everything all this time. His life was secretless as this mean cubicle with its bed, commode, and reading light. So to stand between him and this impossible return, he had his anger to preserve him from love he couldn't really risk. He could settle for interrogating his daughter. The shame he felt was acceptable, the shame and coldness, but she must have picked it up, for she sat now very still except for nervous feet, her voice so subdued he missed parts of her answers. They had sent her here from a place in the mountains, where it was chilly even in summer, surrounded by barbed wire and bright hooded lights that burned all night long. There were no boys, only girls, mothers, old ladies living in barracks stacked up in bunks, often two to a pallet. Laney was well. Sometimes a man in a black uniform came into the barracks and Muti would go away with him and stay away for several days. When she came back, she didn't want to talk or even to hug Ilse the way she usually did. Sometimes she cried and asked Ilse to leave her alone. Ilse would go off and play with Johanna and Lily underneath the barracks next door. They had scooped a hideout there in the dirt, furnished with dolls, hats, dresses, shoes, old bottles, magazines with pictures, all found out near the barbed wire, the treasure pile. They called it a huge refuse dump that always smoldered day and night. You could see its red glow out the window from the top bunk where she slept with Lily nights when Laney was away. But Pekler was hardly listening. He had the only datum with any value, that she was somewhere definite, with a location on the map and authorities who might be contacted. Could he find her again? Fool. Could he somehow negotiate her release? Some man, some red, must have got her into this. Kurt Montaugen was the only one he could trust, though Pekler knew before they spoke that the role Montaugen had chosen would keep him from helping. They called them re-education camps. They're run by the SS. I could talk to Weissmann, but it might not work. He had known Weissmann in Südwest. They had shared the months of siege inside Foppel's villa. Weissmann was one of the people who had driven Montaugen finally away to live in the bush, but they had found a rapprochement here among the rockets, either for sunblasted holy man reasons it was not for Pekler to understand, or because of some deeper connection which had always been there. They stood on the roof of one of the assembly buildings, the Oya across the water 6 miles away, clearly visible, which meant a change in the weather tomorrow. Steel was being hammered somewhere out in the sunlight, hammered in cadences, purified as the song of some bird. Blue Peenemünde shivered around them in all directions, a dream of concrete and steel masses reflecting the noon heat. The air rippled like camouflage. Behind it, something else seemed to carry on in secret. At any moment, the illusion they stood on would dissolve and they would fall to earth. Pekler stared across the marshes, feeling helpless. I have to do something, don't I? No, you have to wait. It's not right, Montaugen. No. What about Ilse? Will she have to go back? I don't know, but she's here now. So, as usual, Pekler chose silence. Had he chosen something else, back while there was time, they all might have saved themselves, even left the country. Now, too late, when at last he wanted to act, there was nothing to act on. Well, to be honest, he didn't spend much time brooding about past neutralities. He wasn't that sure he'd outgrown them anyway. They took walks, he and Ilse, by the stormy shore, fed ducks, explored the pine forests. They even allowed her to watch a launching. It was a message to him, but he didn't understand till later what it meant. It meant that there was no violation of security. There was no one she could tell who mattered. The noise of the rocket ripped at them. For the first time, then, she moved close and held him. He felt that he was holding on to her. The motor cut off too soon, and the rocket crashed somewhere over in Peenemünde West in Luftwaffe territory. The dirty pillar of smoke drew the screaming fire engines and truckloads of workers by in a wild parade. She took in a deep breath and squeezed his hand. Did you make it do that, Papi? End of side 13. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 14. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Fincham. Continuing on page 477. No, it wasn't supposed to. It's supposed to fly in a big curve. Motioning with his hand, the parabola trailing behind encompassing testing stands, assembly buildings, drawing them together as the crosses priests make in the air quarter and divide the staring congregations behind them. Where does it go? Wherever we tell it to. May I fly in it someday? I'd fit inside, wouldn't I? She asked impossible questions.
Someday, Pöckler told her, perhaps someday to the moon. The moon? As if he were going to tell her a story. When none followed, she made up them. The engineer in the next cubicle had a map of the moon tacked to his fiberboard wall, and she spent hours studying it, deciding where she wanted to live. Passing over the bright rays of Kepler, the rugged solitude of southern highlands, the spectacular views at Copernicus and Eratosthenes, she saw a small, pretty crater in a sea of tranquility called Maskelyne B. They would build a house right on the rim, Mutti and she and Pöckler, gold mountains out one window and the wide sea out the other, and earth green and blue in the sky. Should he have told her what the seas of the moon really were? Told her there was nothing to breathe? His ignorance frightened him, his ineptitude as a father. Nights in the cubicle with Ilsa curled a few feet away in a canvas army cot, a little gray squirrel under her blanket, he'd wonder if she wasn't really better off as ward of the Reich. He'd heard there were camps, but saw nothing sinister in it. He took the government at their word. Re-education. I've made such a mess of everything. They have qualified people. They're trained to know. They know what a child needs. Staring up at the electric scatter from this part of Peenemünde, mapping across his piece of ceiling priorities, abandoned dreams, favor in the eyes of the master fantasy in Berlin, while sometimes Ilse whispered to him bedtime stories about the moon she would live on, till he had transferred silently to a world that wasn't this one after all. A map without national borders, insecure and exhilarating, in which flight was as natural as breathing. But I'll fall. No, rising, look down, nothing to be afraid of. This time it's good, yes. Firmly in flight, it's working. Yes. Pöckler may be only witnessing tonight, or he may really be part of it. He hasn't been shown which it is. Look at this. There is about to be expedited for Friedrich August Pekule von Stradonitz, his dream of 1865, the great dream that revolutionized chemistry and made the IG possible, so that the right material may find its way to the right dreamer. Everyone, everything involved must be exactly in place in the pattern. It was nice of Jung to give us the idea of an ancestral pool in which everybody shares the same dream material, but how it is we are each visited as individuals, each by exactly and only what he needs. Doesn't that imply a switching path of some kind? A bureaucracy? Why shouldn't the IG go to seances? They ought to be quite at home with the bureaucracies of the other. Kekule's dream here is being routed now past points which may arc through the silence in bright reluctance to live inside the moving moment, an imperfect, a human light, over here interfering with the solemn binary decisions of these agents, who are now allowing the cosmic serpent, in the violet splendor of its scales, shining that is definitely not human, to pass without feeling, without wonder, after you get a little time in whatever that means over here. One of these archetypes gets to look pretty much like any other. Oh, you hear some of these new hires, the seersucker crowd come in the first day. Wow, hey, that's the tree of creation, huh? Ain't it? Jeepers, but enough. Pick up the reflexes for intent to gawk. You know, self-criticism's an amazing technique. It shouldn't work, but it does. Here's the rundown on Kekule's problem. Started out to become an architect. Turned out instead to be one of the Atlantes of chemistry. Most of the organic wing of that useful edifice bearing down on top of his head forever. Not just under the aspect of IG, but of world. Assuming that's a distinction you observe. Once again, it was the influence of Liebig, the great professor of chemistry on whose name street in Munich Pöckler lived while he attended the TH. Liebig was at the University of Gießen when Kekule entered as a student. He inspired the young man to change his field. So Kekule brought the mind's eye of an architect over into chemistry. It was a critical switch. Liebig himself seems to have occupied the role of a gate, or sorting demon, such as his younger contemporary, Clark Maxwell, once proposed, helping to concentrate energy into one favored room of the creation at the expense of everything else. Later, witnesses have suggested that Clark Maxwell intended his demon not so much as convenience in discussing a thermodynamic idea as a parable about the actual existence of personnel like Liebig. We may gain an indication of how far the repression had grown by that time in the degree to which Clark Maxwell felt obliged to code his warnings. Indeed, some theorists, usually the ones who find sinister meaning behind even Mrs. Clark Maxwell's notorious. It is time to go home, James. You are beginning to enjoy yourself. Have made the extreme suggestion that the field equations themselves contain an ominous forewarning. Cite as evidence the disturbing intimacy of the equations with the behavior of the double integrating circuit in the guidance system of the A4 rocket. The same double summing of current densities that led architect Etzel Oelsch to design for architect Albert Speer an underground factory at Nordhausen with just that symbolic shape. Young ex-architect Kekulé went looking among the molecules of the time for the hidden shapes he knew were there, shapes he did not like to think of as real physical structures but as rational formulas, showing the relationships that went on in metamorphoses, his quaint 19th century way of saying chemical reactions. But he could visualize, he saw, the four bonds of carbon lying in a tetrahedron, how carbon atoms could link up one to another into long chains. But he was stumped when he got to benzene. He knew there were six carbon atoms with a hydrogen attached to each one, but he could not see the shape. Not until the dream. Until he was made to see it, so that others might be seduced by its physical beauty and begin to think of it as a blueprint, a basis for new compounds, new arrangements, so that there would be a field of aromatic chemistry to ally itself with secular power and find new methods of synthesis, so there would be a German dye industry to become the IG. Kekulé dreams the great serpent, holding its own tail in its mouth, the dreaming serpent which surrounds the world. But the meanness, the cynicism with which this dream is to be used, the serpent that announces the world is a closed thing, cyclical, resonant, eternally returning, is to be delivered into a system whose only aim is to violate the cycle, taking and not giving back, demanding that productivity and earnings keep on increasing with time, the system removing from the rest of the world these vast quantities of energy to keep its own tiny, desperate fraction showing a profit. And not only most of humanity, most of the world, animal, vegetable, and mineral, is laid waste in the process. The system may or may not understand that it's only buying time, and that time is an artificial resource to begin with of no value to anyone or system, which sooner or later must crash to its death when its addiction to energy has become more than the rest of the world can supply, dragging with it innocent souls all along the chain of life. Living inside them is like riding across the country in a bus driven by a maniac bent on suicide. Though he's amiable, keeps cracking jokes back. Good morning, folks. This is Heidelberg here. We're coming into now. You know the old refrain, I lost in Heidelberg. Well, I have a friend who lost both his ears here. Don't get me wrong. It's really a nice town. The people are warm and wonderful when they're not bullying. Seriously, though, they treat you just fine. They don't just give you the key to the city. They give you the bungser und so weiter. On you roll across a countryside whose light is forever changing. Castles, heaps of rock, moons of different shapes and colors come and go. There are stops at odd hours of the mornings for reasons that are not announced. Out to stretch in lime-lit courtyards where the old men sit around the table under enormous eucalyptus trees you can smell in the night, shuffling the ancient decks oily and worn, throwing down swords and cups and trumps major in the tremor of light while behind them the bus is idling, waiting. Passengers will now reclaim their seats. Much as you'd like to stay right here, learn the game, find your old age around this quiet table. It's no. He is waiting beside the door of the bus in his pressed uniform. Lord of the night, he is checking your tickets, your ID and travel papers, and it's the wands of enterprise that dominate tonight. As he nods you by, you catch a glimpse of his face, his insane, committed eyes, and you remember for a terrible few heartbeats. And of course it will end for you all in blood, in shock, without dignity. But there is meanwhile this trip to be on. Over your own seat, where there ought to be an advertising plaque, is instead a quote from Rilke. Once, only once. One of their favorite slogans. No return, no salvation, no cycle. That's not what they, nor their brilliant employee Kekule, have taken the serpent to mean. No, what the serpent means is, how's this, that the 6 carbon atoms of benzene are in fact curled around into a closed ring, just like that snake with its tail in its mouth. Get it? The aromatic ring we know today. Peckler's Olaf Laszlo Jampf at this point in the spiel, removing from his fob a gold hexagon with a German Fourme cross in the center,
a medal of honor from I.G. Farben, joking in his lovable old fart manner to think of the cross not as German so much as standing for the tetravalency of carbon. But who, lifting his open hands on each beat like a bandleader, who sent the dream?
It is never clear how rhetorical any of Jampf's questions are. Who sent this new serpentinous guard, and already too fouled, too crowded to qualify as any locus of innocence, unless innocence be our age's neutral, our silent passing into the machineries of indifference, something that Kekule's serpent had come to, not to destroy, but to define to us the loss of? We had been given certain molecules, certain combinations, and not others. We used what we found in nature, unquestioning, shamefully perhaps, but the serpent whispered, they can be changed. And new molecules assembled from the debris of the given. Can anyone tell me what else he whispered to us? Come, who knows? You, tell me, Berkler. His name fell on him like a thunderclap. And of course it wasn't Professor Dr. Jampf, after all, but a colleague from down the hall who had pulled reveille duty that morning. Ilse was brushing her hair and smiling at him. His daytime work had started to go better. Others were not so distant and more apt to look in his eyes. They'd met Ilse and been charmed. If he saw anything else in their faces, he ignored it.
Then one evening he returned from the Oya a little drunk, a little anxious, elated over a firing the next day, and found his cubicle empty.
Ilse, her flowered bag, the clothing she usually left strewn on the cot, had all vanished. Nothing left but a wretched sheet of log paper, which Berkler found so useful for taming the terror of exponential curves into the linear, the safe, the same kind she'd drawn pictures of her moon house on. Papi, they want me back. Maybe they'll let me see you again. I hope so. I love you, Ilse. Coach Mondaugen found Berkler lying on her cot, breathing what he imagined were cups of her hair on the pillow. For a while then he went a little insane, talked of killing Weissmann, sabotaging the rocket program, and quitting his job and seeking asylum in England. Mondaugen sat and listened to all of it, touched Berkler once or twice, smoked his pipe, till at last, at 2 or 3 in the morning, Berkler had talked through a number of unreal options, cried, cursed, punched a hole into his neighbor's cubicle, through which he heard the man snoring unoblivious. Cooled by then to a vexed engineer elitism, they are fools, they don't even know what sine and cosine are, and they're trying to tell me. He agreed that yes, he must wait, and let them do what they would do. If I set up a meeting with Weissmann, Mondaugen did suggest, could you be graceful, calm? No, not with him, not yet. When you think you are ready, let me know. When you're ready, you'll know how to handle it. Had he allowed himself a tone of command? He must have seen how much Berkler needed to be at someone's command. Lainey had learned to subdue her husband with her face, knew what cruel lines he expected of her mouth, what tones of voice he needed. When she left him, she left an unemployed servant who'd go with the first master that called, just a victim in a vacuum. Nur ein Opfer, sehr ins Vakuum. Won't somebody take advantage of me? Wird niemand ausnutzen mich auch? Just a slave with nobody to slave for. Nur ein Sklave ohne Herrin. Ja, ta, ta, ta. Hey, and who the heck wants that be free? Wer zum Teufel die Freiheit braucht? All together now, all you masochists out there, especially those of you who don't have a partner tonight, alone with those fantasies that don't look like they'll ever come true, want you just to join in here with your brothers and sisters, let each other know you're alive and sincere, try to break through the silences, try to reach through and connect. Aw, the sodium lights aren't so bright in Berlin. I go to the bars, dear, but nobody's in. Oh, I'd much rather be in a Greek tragedy than be a victim in a vacuum tonight. Days passed, much like one another to Berkler. Identical moon plunges into a routine dreary as winter now. He learned to keep an outward calm, at least. Learned to feel the gathering, the moving toward war that is unique to weapons programs. At first it simulates depression or non-specific anxiety. There may be esophageal spasms and unrecoverable dreams. You find you are writing notes to yourself. First thing in the morning, calm, reasoned assurances to the screaming mental case inside. 1. It is a combination. 1.1. It is a scalar quantity. 1.2. Its negative aspects are distributed isotropically. 2. It is not a conspiracy. It is not a vector. 2.11. It is not aimed at anybody. 2.12. It is not aimed at me. Und so weiter. The coffee became more and more metallic. Each deadline is now a crisis. Each is more intense than the last. Behind this job, like any other job, seems to lie something void, something terminal, something growing closer each day to manifestation. The new planet Pluto, she had whispered long ago, lying in the smelly dark, her long ashen upper lip gibbous that night as the moon that ruled her. A sign now, held tight in its claws, it moves slowly, so slowly and so far away. But it will burst out. It is the grim phoenix which creates its own holocaust. Deliberate resurrection. Staged, under control, no grace, no interventions by God. Some are calling it a net of National Socialism. Brunhübner and that crowd all trying to suck out. They don't know they are telling the literal truth. Are you awake, Franz? Closer, the game of priorities and politicking grew more earnest. Army versus Luftwaffe, the weapons department versus the Ministry of Munitions, the SS, given their aspirations, versus everybody else, and even a simmering discontent that was to grow over the next few years in revolt against von Braun because of his youth and a number of test failures, though heaven knew there were always enough of those. They were the raw material of all testing station politics. In general, though, the test results grew more and more hopeful. It was impossible not to think of the rocket without thinking of Schicksal, of growing toward a shape predestined and perhaps a little otherworldly. The crews launched an uncontrolled series of A-5s, bringing some of them down by parachute, reaching a height of 5 miles and nearly to the speed of sound. Though the guidance people had still a long way to go, they had by this point switched over to vanes made of graphite, brought the yaw oscillations down to 5 degrees or so, and grown measurably happier about the rocket's stability. At some point in the winter, Pechler came to feel that he could handle a meeting with Weissman. He found the SS man on guard behind eyeglasses like Wagnerian shields, ready for unacceptable maxima, anger, accusation, a moment of office violence. It was like meeting a stranger. They had not spoken since the days at Kummersdorf, at the old Raketenflugplatz. In this quarter hour at Peenemünde, Pechler smiled more than he had in the year previous, spoke of his admiration for Perlmann's work in devising a cooling system for the propulsion. "What about the hot spots?" Weissman asked. It was a reasonable question, but also an intimacy. It came to Pechler that the man didn't give a damn about heating problems. This was a game, as Morgan had warned, ritualized as jiu-jitsu. "We've got heat flow densities," he usually did when he sang, "on the order of 3 million kilocalories per m2 degree centigrade. Regenerative cooling is the best interim solution right now, but Perlmann has a new approach," showing him with chalk and slate, trying for the professional. "He feels that if we use a film of alcohol on the inside of the chamber, we can reduce the heat transfer by a considerable amount." "You'll be injecting it." "Correct. How much fuel is that going to reroute? How's it going to affect the engine efficiency?" Pechler had the figures. "Right now, injection is a plumber's nightmare, but with the delivery schedules as they are, what about the two-stage combustion process?" "Gives us more volume, better turbulence, but there's also a non-isotropic pressure drop which cuts into. We're trying any number of approaches. If we could depend on better funding..." "Ah, not my department. We could do with a more generous budget ourselves." They both laughed then. Gentlemen scientists, under a stingy bureaucracy, suffering together. Pechler understood that he had been negotiating for his child and for Lainey, that the questions and answers were not exactly code for something else, but in the way of an evaluation of Pechler personally. He was expected to behave a certain way, not just to play a role, but to live it. Any deviations into jealousy, metaphysics, vagueness would be picked up immediately. He would either be directed back on course or allowed to fall. Through winter and spring, the sessions with Weissman became routine. Perkler grew into his new disguise, prematurely aged adolescent whiz, often finding that it could indeed take him over, him longer at reference books and firing data, speaking lines for him he could never have planned in advance, gentle, scholarly, racket-obsessed language that surprised him. Late August, he had his second visit. It should have been Ilse returned, but Perkler wasn't sure. As before, she showed up alone, unannounced, ran to him, kissed him, called him Papi, but her hair, for one thing, was definitely dark brown and cut differently. Her eyes were longer, set differently, her complexion less fair. It seemed she'd grown taller, but at that age, shoot up overnight, don't they? If it was that age... Even as Perkler embraced her, the perverse whispering began, "Is it the same one? Have they sent you a different child? Why didn't you look closer last time, Perkler?" This time he asked how long they were going to let her stay. "They'll tell me, and I'll try to let you know." And would there be time for him to recalibrate from his little squirrel who dreamed of living on the moon to this dark, long-legged southern creature whose awkwardness and need of a father were so touching, so clear even to Perkler at this their second, or was it first, or third, meet? Hardly any news of Lainey. They had been separated, Ilse said, during the winter. She'd heard a rumor mother had been moved to a different... So. Present a pawn, withdraw the queen. Reisman waiting to see how Perkler would react. This time he had gone too far. Perkler laced up his shoes and calmly enough went out looking for the SS man, cornered him in his office, denounced him before a panel of three dim governmental figures, the speech eloquently climaxing as he threw chessboard and pieces at Reisman's arrogantly bling face. Perkler's impetuous, yes, a rebel. But, Generaldirektor, it's his kind of fire, and honestly, we need... The child had suddenly come into his arms to kiss him again. Free. Perkler forgot his troubles and held her to his heart for a long time without speaking. But that night, a cubicle, only breathing, no moon wishes this year, from her cot, he was awake wondering, one daughter, one impostor, daughter twice, two impostors, beginning to work out the combinations for a third visit, a fourth. Weissman, those behind him, had thousands of these children. As the years passed, as they grew more nubile, would Perkler even come to fall in love with one? Would she reach the king's row that way and become a queen substitute for lost, for forgotten Lainey? The opponent knew that Perkler's suspicion would always be stronger than any fears about real incest. They could make up new rules, complicate the game indefinitely. How could any man as empty as Perkler felt that night be flexible enough for that? Cut. It was ridiculous. Hadn't he seen her go by from every angle in their old city rooms? Carried, asleep, crying, crawling, laughing, hungry. Often he had come home too tired to make it to the bed and had lain on the floor with his head under the one wood table, curled, beaten, wondering if he could even sleep. The first time Ilse noticed, she crawled over and sat staring at him for a time. She had seen him still, horizontal, with his eyes shut. He drifted toward sleep. Ilse leaned over and bit him the leg, as she bit crusts of bread, cigarettes, shoes, anything that might be food. "I'm your father. You're inert and edible." Perkler screamed and rolled out of the way. Ilse began to cry. He was too tired to want to think about discipline. It was Lainey, finally, who calmed her down. He knew all Ilse's cryings. Her first attempt at words, the colors of her, the sounds and shapes that brought her tranquility. He ought to know if this child was his own or not, but he didn't. Too much happened between. Too much history and dream. Next morning, his group leader handed Perkler a footchit and a paycheck with a vacation bonus. No travel restrictions, but a time limit of 2 weeks. Translation, will you come back? He packed some things and they got on the train for Staten. The sheds and assembly building gantries that were the map of word shadowing into great purple, isolated across the marsh backs away. Not to come back? He'd left their destination up there. She chose Zwölfkinder. It was the end of summer, nearly the end of peacetime. The children knew what was coming. Playing refugee, they crowded the railway carriages, quieter, more solemn than Perkler had expected, being an urge to start babbling each time Ilse's eyes turned from the window toward his own. He saw the same thing in all their eyes. He was strange to them, to her, and growing stranger, and he knew of no way to reverse it. In a corporate state, a place must be made for innocence and its many uses. In developing an official version of innocence, the culture of childhood has proven invaluable. Games, fairy tales, legends from history, all the paraphernalia of make-believe can be adapted and even embodied in a physical place, such as at Zwölfkinder. Over the children's resort, almost a spa. If you were in, I couldn't get inside the city limits without a child escort. There was a child mayor, a child city council of 12. Children picked up the papers, fruit peelings, and bottles you left in the street. Children gave you guided tours through the Tierpark, the hoard of the Nibelungen, cautioning you to silence during the impressive reenactment of Bismarck's elevation at the spring equinox of 1871 to Prince and Imperial Chancellor. Child police reprimanded you if you were caught alone, without your child accompanying. Whoever carried on the real business of the town, it could not have been children, they were well hidden. A late summer, a late retrospective blooming, birds flew everywhere, the sea warmed, the sun shone on into the evenings. Random children took your shirt cuff by mistake and trudged along for minutes before discovering you were not their adult and then wandered off with backward smiles. The glass mountain twinkled rose and white in the hot sun. The elf king and his queen made a royal progress every noon with a splendid retinue of dwarves and sprites, handing out cakes, ices, and candies. At each intersection or square, bands played. Marches, folk dances, hot jazz, Hugo Wolf. Children went streaming like confetti at the drinking fountains where soda water sparkled deep inside the fanged mouths of dragons, of wild lions and tigers. The queues of children waited, each for his moment of danger, leaning halfway into the shadow, into the smell of wet cement and old water, into the mouth of the beast to drink. In the sky, the tall Ferris wheel spun. From Peenemünde they had come 280 kilometers, which was to be, coincidentally, the operational range of the A4. Among all there was to choose from, wheel, myths, jungle animals, clowns, Ilse found her way to the Antarctic panorama. Two or three boys, hardly older than she, wandered through the imitation wilderness, bundled up in seal skins, constructing cairns and planting flags in the August humidity. Watching them made Perkla sweat. A few sled dogs lay suffering in the shade of the dirty papier-mâché sastrugi, on plaster snow that had begun to crack. A hidden projector threw images of the aurora on a white scrim. Half a dozen stuffed penguins also dotted the landscape.
So you want to live at the South Pole? Have you given up so easily on...
Caught. Idiot, that was a slip.
On the moon...
He'd been good up till then about cross-examining. He couldn't afford to know who she was.
In the false Antarctic, in ignorance of what had attracted her there, uneasy and dripping sweat, he waited for her answer.
She or they let him off.
Oh, with a shrug, who wants to live on the moon?
They never brought it up again. Back at their hotel, they were handed the key by an 8-year-old desk clerk. Rose in a whining elevator run by a uniformed child to a room still warm from the day's heat. She closed the door, took off her hat, and scaled it over to her bed. Perkla collapsed on his own bed. She came over to take off his shoes.
Papi, gravely unlacing, may I sleep next to you tonight?
One of her hands had come lightly to rest on the beginning of his bare calf. Their eyes met for half a second. A number of uncertainties shifted then for Perkler and locked into sense. To his shame, his first feeling was pride. He hadn't known he was so vital to the program. Even in this initial moment, he was seeing it from their side. Every quirk goes in the dossier, gambler, foot fetishist, or soccer fan. It's all important. It can all be used. Right now, we have to keep them happy, or at least neutralize the foci of their unhappiness. You may not understand what their work really is, not at the level of the data, but you're an administrator, after all, a leader. Your job is to get results. Perkler now has mentioned a daughter, yes. Yes, we know it's disgusting. One never can tell what they have locked up in there with those equations, but we must all put off our judgments for now. There'll be time after the war to get back to the Perklers and their dirty little secrets. He hit her upside the head with his open hand, a loud and terrible blow. That took care of his anger.
Then before she could cry or speak, he had dragged her up on the bed next to him, her dazed little hands already at the buttons of his trousers, her white frock already pulled above her waist. She had been wearing nothing at all underneath, nothing all day. "How I've wanted you," she whispered as paternal plow found its way into filial furrow. And after hours of amazing incest, they dressed in silence and crept out into the leading edge of faintest flesh dawn, everything they would need packed inside her flowered bag, past sleeping children doomed to the end of summer, past monitors and railway guards, down at last to the water and the fishing boats, to a fatherly old sea dog in a braided captain's hat, who welcomed them aboard and stashed them below decks, where she snuggled down in the bunk as they got underway and sucked him for hours, while the engine pounded, till the captain called, "Come on up and take a look at your new home." Gray and green, through the mist, it was Denmark. "Yes, there are free people here. Good luck to both of you." The three of them, there on deck,